Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College, all things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there, and of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale.
Good morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. Israel's war cabinet continues to meet the third time today. Not sure that it is clear. It is reported by the Times of Israel that the Israeli Defense Forces have wrapped up northern Israel war simulation drills. NBC News is reporting that the U.S. officials, again, this is Club Appeasement, so you can't trust them. Club Appeasement is Joe Biden and Secretary Blinken and Jake Sullivan and David Cameron and Rishi Sunak. Club Appeasement believes that the U.S. will try to hit the proxies and not Iran directly, but that's wish casting. I don't know what they're going to do. Maybe they will go after Hezbollah in a full-blown invasion of northern Israel. We will see. Israel has told its Arab neighbors that its response to Iran will not endanger them. So if anything goes at Iran, it will go over Syria and Iraq. So it will not go over Jordan or any of the Arabian Peninsula Sunni countries. Lots of discussion about what they could do in the Telegraph, but none of it matters. We don't know. It's all speculation. It's all disinformation. Churchill said truth must be guarded in a bodyguard of lies. And so I expect lots of leaks, disinformation. Iran is now sweating it out in the way that Israel sweated it out all day Friday and Saturday. American markets are, I'll come back to that in the next segment when I do my AmericanFederal.com market report, have reacted now, finally, to the idea that something's going to happen. The U.S. has accused Hamas of being an obstacle to the Gaza truce. You think they rejected it? And they said, by the way, they only have 20 hostages who qualify for the humanitarian category. 20. So another 20 apparently have died. We don't know. Yesterday, anti-Israel activists blocked bridges in New York City, California, Chicago, and around the country. They're pro-Hamas, right? They're pro-Hamas, they're pro-Hezbollah, they're anti-Semitic, they're anti-Jew, they're anti-Israel. I went on Martha McCollum show yesterday on Fox and was asked about these demonstrators. Cut number 10.
Hugh, it's always struck me that the heinous, brutal nature of the October 7th attack was intentional because it provoked an enormous response, right, in Gaza. And now it has provoked further divisions by the biggest supporter of Israel, the United States. And we see that happening across the country. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's unwise for people to speak out on behalf of anything to do with Hamas. I think it's unwise for these demonstrators to be showing any kind of support for them because Sinwar is watching from his tunnel and supporters of Hamas are watching from their various redoubts in Gaza. Hezbollah is watching. The Ayatollah Khomeini is watching. And they think they're winning. They don't understand that this is not a representative group of Americans. And more importantly, Club Appeasement over at the White House, where they're urging Israel not to respond. They're watching and they are politically scared to death. They are afraid these people are going to Chicago, and they are going to Chicago. They are afraid that gas prices are going to go up because when Israel strikes Iran, they're going to actually impact oil supplies. And that the president's in a political bind. I understand why they want everyone to go back. It isn't going to happen with this kind of thing going on.
And when I say they're going to Chicago, they're going to Chicago in August. They're all going to the Democratic Convention, all of these demonstrators and protesters. There's nothing Joe Biden can do about his left flank because his left flank is nuts and they are pro-Hamas. They don't have any idea what it means. Martha came back to me.
I'm struck by a few things watching this. These protesters have a very specific goal. They call out the president, Joe Biden, on a daily basis. They call him Genocide Joe. They want him to end his support for Israel. And they are coming out in force. And then I think about the fact that I think it was about 50 members of Congress signed a letter, including Nancy Pelosi, saying that because of what was happening in Gaza, they did not support continued weapons sales to Israel. So is this protest effort, Hugh, is it working?
I think it is, Martha, and I do think it is working because of the White House's response to the unprecedented attack on Israel on Saturday night. And I do believe the response of the White House was to try and get Israel not to respond, and that's the direct response to this, which is a preview of coming actions, like a long trailer for the Chicago convention the Democrats are going to put on in Chicago in August. All these folks are going to go there. The good news, Martha, they're not in the Trump jury pool, so I'm glad about that. The other good news, everybody in their car, everybody watching at home, is more and more moving towards putting Trump in the fall as they watch the collapse of order. The bad news is, I don't know how ignorant these people are, Hamas or Hezbollah is, but it's got to be fairly ignorant, because I can't imagine any American in their right mind marching for terrorism.
That is the bottom line. They're marching for terrorism. They are marching for terrorism. There's a Wall Street Journal story. Israel-Iran confrontation forces Gulf power to choose sides. Well, it's okay. The best thing you can read today is my Fox News column. I've done two in a row because we are on the edge of a big deal here, and it's begun. It's been going on since 10-7. We're in the middle of 6. This new one is Biden's red line is erased. That's not original to me. As I note in the column, and I urge you, I put links over at X. If you Google Hugh Hewitt Fox News, it'll take you to every column I write for Fox News, just like if you Google Hugh Hewitt and Washington Post, it'll take you to every column I write for the Washington Post. I steal a lot with a credit to the gang at Commentary Podcast. It is a must-listen podcast in these times. They do what news podcasts do. They cover the news, and they're lighthearted, and they do commentary recommends. I found out that Joe Epstein has a new book out from Matt Conaney yesterday, so that's good to know. But most of the conversation was devoted to this, and they have a bet on whether or not we're going to get a response from Israel directed at Iran and into Rafah. I think Israel's both going to hit Iran and go into Rafah. There's a middle ground on hitting Iran, which is to hit every Iranian in Syria and Lebanon and to go into Lebanon. That might be the more strategically apt response, and then dare and be prepared and tell the White House if they come back with one whisper of a retaliation, we'll just crush their refineries, which is why markets are down. And I steal everything from the five people when they got a full house are Abe Greenwald, executive editor of Commentary, Matt Continetti at AEI, Seth Mandel, senior columnist at Commentary, John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, and Christine Rosen, the media columnist for the Commentary Magazine podcast. Yesterday's podcast is the best discussion. I listened to a lot. And television discussions are great. Martha had a good one. Brett had a good one. I'll talk to Brett a little bit later. But if you need an hour to unpack all of the craziness in the club appeasement response. It's the model UN security, national security team. Everything they learned in high school that everyone will work everything out eventually and you all go home with a trophy. That's not how it works in the real world. It works in the real world with an Arab girl struggling for her life, a Bedouin girl who was hit by the Iranian attack, and nobody else. But they did hit an Israeli Air Force, and I believe Gallant went there yesterday, Air Force Base, and Gallant, the defense secretary in Israel, went there yesterday. Don't worry, we're coming back, we're going to do something. But they've got a long list of things, from cyber attacks to physical attacks to what to do in, that was Gantz you just saw there, what to do in South Lebanon and go into Rafah. And Israel should do it all as quickly as it can, just as quickly as it can. Meanwhile, Speaker Johnson is going to put four bills on the floor. Aid for Israel, I think it will pass. Aid for Ukraine, I think it will pass. Aid for Taiwan, I think it will pass. And a supplemental for American military, I think it will pass the House. And then the Senate can take up each of them in turn. And I'm all in favor of all this because we are in a world war. You may not know it. You may not like it. You may not want to recognize it. And you may want the other team to win. And by team, I mean Iran, China, and Russia. China is the senior partner. Russia and Iran are the junior partners, but they're far more reckless than China. And below that, we have North Korea and Venezuela and Cuba. And below that, we got the crazy proxies and the Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas and the little green men all over Africa. It's a world war. We're in the middle of this world war. And if you will not recognize that, I can't help you. If you want to march around, both of my alma maters are just an embarrassment to the world, Michigan and Harvard. Embarrassments. They had the grad students at Michigan yesterday doing chants. Everything is an embarrassment in America from the left. You can't vote for any Democrat because whether or not they're the sane ones like Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, or John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, they're overwhelmingly outnumbered by Chuck Schumer's and Joe Biden's and Tony Blinken's. So you've just got to decide, do you want this country to endure? Do you want Israel to endure? Even Europe can't figure it out. David Cameron, Rishi Sunak cannot get thrown out of office soon enough. I've never said that about a Tory government before. We got to get the appeasers out. Hope Ben Wallace takes over the party. And if you're a Republican, you're driving into the Capitol today, be prepared to vote yes, 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 and yes. Or just be prepared to be dumb. You're really dumb if you don't vote for all four. Dumb, dumb, dumb. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. The appeasement club at the White House, the model UN national security team, continues to message via leaks. This morning, they're messaging that the U.S. is said to believe Israel won't strike Iran directly, will focus on proxies instead. I don't believe any of this stuff, but what does Senator Tom Cotton think? Good morning, Senator. Welcome back.
Hey, Hugh. Good morning. Good to be back on with you.
So do you think that the Biden administration is whiskcasting again? They're trying to influence Israeli behavior by telling them what they would prefer them to do?
I think that's what's going on, Hugh. I mean, the president has a very bad habit of trying to restrain Israel, sometimes publicly, more often with these anonymous statements on background, pressuring Prime Minister Netanyahu and his war cabinet not to take action that Israel deems vital to its national security, first destroying Hamas and Gaza, and now responding to one of the single largest missile and drones attacks in the history of warfare. The president shouldn't have gone out last week and said, don't, as if a single word is a foreign policy. We saw that worked with Vladimir Putin in 2022, only to have the Ayatollahs making him look like a fool. And then he shouldn't have told Prime Minister Netanyahu to, quote unquote, take the win, as if it's a win to have 300 missiles and drones shot at your country, and certainly if you don't respond to it. And then the president again turned around and he leaked that immediately. All this does is simply project weakness and hesitancy and equivocation to Iran, making Iran even more likely to attack more ferociously in the future. So I wouldn't presume to tell Israel how they will respond. I can tell you how I would respond if that happened to America, and it wouldn't be, quote unquote, taking the win as Joe Biden wants to.
Now, that was, is it though, Neville Chamberlain came back from the Munich summit and told the Czechs, hey, take the win. It's only the Sudetenland I'm giving up, even though, you know, what happens with appeasement. Do you think they're appeasers? Senator, am I being too hard on them to call them appeasers?
No, Hugh, I think that's the generous interpretation, is that they're appeasers and they're cowardly and they're scared of their own shadow. Let me just give you an example, Hugh, of what's happening in the Red Sea. To our own sailors, this is not happening to a bunch of foreign merchant mariners. This is happening to U.S. Navy sailors. They're sitting in the Red Sea. The Pentagon is boasting that these sailors have, quote, been in the weapons engagement envelope for more time than any ship since World War II. What that bit of bureaucratic jargon from the Navy means is they've been sitting ducks to Yemeni weapons for longer than any time since World War II. That's not a success story, Hugh. That's not a good news story. That's a failure, because all this president is willing to do while those sailors are sitting ducks is to blow up missiles or drones that are in the air coming at U.S. Navy ships. Again, not merchant vessels, U.S. Navy ships, or maybe blow them up when they're on the launch pad getting ready to strike. He refuses to get on offense against these outlaw rebels in Yemen and blow up their manufacturing sites and their munition storage sites and their command and control centers, because, again, he is fearful of escalation, just like he pussyfooted around for 2 years in Ukraine, fearful of escalation, when what that projected fearfulness does is just guarantee that your adversary escalate. The way to avoid escalation, Hugh, is to establish what you might call escalation dominance.
Escalation dominance is a good term. Senator, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates took on the Houthis for years, and they did not make as much progress as they had hoped. And I don't know why that is. Would the United States be able to secure the space and then leave if it had to and invite in our Sunni allies to supervise as they were once deployed there until we obliged them to leave?
Well, Hugh, I think militarily, with the right intelligence, which takes a bit of time to develop, and there's no question that we could destroy the war-making capability of these brigands in Yemen, certainly to prevent our sailors from having to just wait around like sitting ducks in the weapons engagement envelope for weeks on the end. Now, Yemen has long been an unstable country with a troubled history. America has no business going into Yemen and trying to stabilize it or create a some kind of democratic governance like it's Denmark or the Netherlands. But after we, with partners in the region, destroy these rebels' war-making capabilities, at least that it's, so it's no longer a threat to our sailors or our troops in the region or Israel and other partners in the region, I'm confident that nations like Saudi Arabia, which has deep historic ties with Yemen, and the United Arab Emirates could help stabilize Yemen in some way that stops this threat to American interests.
Do you understand why they weren't able to? I really don't have any idea how the UAE, which is little Sparta, according to General Mattis, and Saudi Arabia, which has got a pretty good army, how were they not able to advance upon the Houthis?
Well, part of it, Hugh, is that the Obama administration didn't provide the support that I think they should have, because, again, you have so many in the Democratic Party who see the Middle East through the lens of American partisan politics, and any nation that was opposed to Barack Obama's nuclear deal is viewed as wearing a red jersey. That would include Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And the height of that war was starting right as the Iran nuclear debate was happening here in America. And therefore, you had a lot of Democrats in the Congress putting pressure on the Obama administration not to enable Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis to go for the jugular against these rebels in Yemen. But again, it just goes to show the best way to deter a threat is not to manage it carefully, not to try to gradually tinker around the edges of it, but to go for the jugular and eliminate it.
Now, Senator Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, is going to bring four bills to the House floor. One is going to be for Israel, one's going to be for Ukraine, one's going to be for Taiwan, one's going to be for our industrial base. What's your advice to your colleagues in the House? Because I want them to vote for all four. Ryan Zinke just told me he doesn't think he's going to vote for Ukraine because there's too much in it. What's your? I really don't want to waste money, but I also don't want to waste time.
So, Hugh, I support all those initiatives, of course. I want to back Ukraine. I, of course, want to back Israel. Taiwan needs to be bolstered as well, and their own industrial base badly needs improvement. I also gather they're going to include a new and improved version of their TikTok and foreign adversary social media app bill in there. Those are all good things. I haven't seen the text of these bills. One reason that I didn't care for the Senate version of the bill is that it included about $19 billion of non-military aid to include billions of dollars of humanitarian aid that could have gone to Gaza at a time when Israel's still in the middle of a shooting war and Hamas is still in control of how that aid is distributed. So when they're writing the final content of that bill, putting aside procedural questions, I would encourage my friends in the House to look at military aid only, maybe make some or all of that military aid form of loans, make sure that we're not sending aid to Hamas-controlled Gaza, because remember, Hamas doesn't divert aid in Gaza, it accepts it. And then focus especially on what we need to improve our military industrial base. All these countries need these weapons now, but more than anything, they and America need America to be able to make a lot more of these weapons a lot faster going forward.
So last question, Senator. The demonstrations have paralyzed the president, and he's also afraid of any disruption to oil supply raising gas prices. Do you think he ought to hit the refineries that Iran has, even if it hits us in the pocketbook? Because the world oil supply is one market. If we disrupt their refining capability and hit them in their pocketbook, we'll pay part of that price. Should we do so?
So the real question is what Israel's going to do. Israel is a nation that was attacked, Hugh. I think oil refineries are an obvious vulnerability of Iran. Everyone's known that for a very long time. Another vulnerability are their drone and missile manufacturing sites, many of which are not deeply buried the way their nuclear sites are. I think the president should certainly back Israel to the hilt, whatever Israel decides to do, to make sure that the Ayatollahs are scared straight and never undertake another attack like they did on Saturday night. What the president should not be doing is discouraging Israel from striking those refineries. like he is discouraging Ukraine from striking Russian refineries. And the reason for that, Hugh, is purely political in the electoral sense. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin admitted last week under my questioning at his hearing at the Armed Services Committee that the Biden administration is discouraging Ukraine from striking Russian oil refineries because they don't want the price of gasoline to go up in America. They are only worried about Joe Biden's reelection and largely conducting foreign policy based on electoral college strategy, which is a complete dereliction of their duty.
All right, last question, which is political. Do you think the show trial unfolding in New York is going to help Donald Trump? I do. I actually think he's going to win points for this because it's so blatantly a political prosecution and abuse of process and justice.
Well, Hugh, it should help him because it highlights how the Democratic Party's entire political strategy this year has become the weaponization of the legal system. The prosecutor in New York City has brought charges that the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Manhattan, refused to bring, and that his own predecessor in New York refused to bring. It's not even clear that these charges are within the statute of limitations. He's got to cite some other underlying crime that he won't even settle on yet. So this is clearly a political witch hunt that's designed to hurt Donald Trump and his election campaign. That's all there is to it. And I think every day that this trial goes on, it becomes more and more apparent. So I'm hopeful that the good people of New York who are seated on that jury will see through it, or at least one of them will see through it and refuse to go along with this political witch hunt.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you as always for joining me. Follow Senator Cotton over at Sen Tom Cotton on X. Thank you, Senator. Welcome back, America. Congressman Ryan Zinke is from the great state of Montana, former Secretary of the Interior as well, former member of SEAL Team 6. Good morning, Congressman. Welcome. I want to get right to it. What do you think Israel should do today? You're a warrior. What do you think Israel should do and decide?
Well, you know, I think at the end of the day, if someone punches you, you punch back. And, you know, you got to look at where we've been. Is that the Houthis, the Hamas, Hezbollah, all drinking from the same well, all funded by Iran. So now you have Iran launch a massive strike, although not successful. It was still a launch, a direct launch. So it's no longer a surrogate war. I think Israel should respond. I think the U.S. should have responded. When Biden said, oh, well, don't hit us or don't do it, as soon as they launched, what was our initial reaction? We knocked them out, but they didn't lose anything. And a lot of deterrence is only deterrence if you actually deter, if it changes behavior. But to date, I don't see Iran's behavior changing at all.
Well,
I'm fully confident that Red Sea is going to continue to have missiles, you know, launched across it. Iran will continue to do what they've always done, is they've funded international terrorism. Until you get to the root of the problem, Iran, I think it will continue.
Congressman Zinke, lost in this is that Iran's commandos landed on a freighter and stole it. The fourth one they've done that. Should we allow that to go unanswered? They are destroying international shipping in that region.
You know, I'll go one step further. I would have said if you launch, you're going to lose your Navy. Right now, again, Iran is launching missiles. They have Red Sea. You have international terrorism. They haven't changed their behavior one bit. And until they do change their behavior, and that is losing pieces, whether it's an oil refinery, whether it's their Navy, et cetera, they're going to continue launching missiles and doing harm in the Middle East.
Congressman Zinke, Speaker Johnson announced he's bringing four bills to the floor, a funding bill for Israel, a funding bill for Ukraine, a funding bill for Taiwan, and a funding bill for our own American industrial base. Will you be voting yes on all or any of them, and which ones?
Well, I will not be voting yes on all of them. With Ukraine, you know, I'm a Reagan Republican. I think unless the U.S. leads, no one else can. But no blank checks. And, you know, $60 billion when the U.S. is suffering. And, oh, by the way, if you really look at national security, you know, borders should be number one. You know, our border is important. So now we're protecting other people's borders and we're not doing anything inside. That's a Biden failure. But, you know, I do think we will give some aid, lethal aid. I would like to see defensive aid shore up our stockpiles. I certainly see that. I think what's going to happen in Ukraine is, you know, I'm a zero on pensions. I think we need to restock our materials. That's important on that. And some defense. So I think something will come out of it. But a blank check with me, I just can't see that happening. Taiwan continue. Yeah, here's an idea in Taiwan. They've already paid for military hardware. How about we deliver it on our side? So this administration's been sitting on it for a while. Deliver what they've paid for. You know, and continue to do naval operations in the Pacific. Right now, Ukraine, we're $130 billion in. We still don't have a plan. We still don't have objectives. And here, you know, I was a Navy SEAL. I've been on a lot of, you know, combat operations in my life. I've never been on an administrative operation without objectives and a plan.
So, now, you know, Congressman, plan? I would vote what, for the
you know,
Ukraine
are
bill.
Are going to go with Crimea or what?
I would vote for the Ukraine bill, even though it would be wasted in some part. I would still vote for it because they are part of this Western effort. And Russia and Iran, they're the same enemy. I keep telling people, Iran, China, and Russia, it's a three-headed hydra. Do you agree with my strategic sense of the situation?
I think the new axis of evil is exactly right. Russia, Iran, China, they're doing joint naval operations in the Persian Gulf. They have exchanged tactics, techniques, and procedures, equipment in the last, you know, few months. So, yeah, the new axis is that, you know, Ukraine aid, lethal aid, but, you know, and I don't have any taste for pension funds or
neither do I.
Small business opportunities in Kiev. So, you know, focus it down to military hardware. Make sure it's as defensive in nature. I'm not a big fan for cluster bombs or deep strike capability in Ukraine. But I am for defending themselves. And look, you know, the reason why we're here is Biden administration failures. They keep on putting boxes in, and those boxes on options getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So, you know, how we got here, Afghanistan, weakness, Ukraine, no plan. Israel, we say we're going to support you, but we don't when it comes down to them launching ICBMs and a massive drone strike. You have Venezuela on fire. You have Haiti. You know, our foreign policy is a disaster. Our allies don't trust us. You know, our enemies don't fear us. Say, well, you know, who was in us? Who was in with us on shooting down the strikes from Iran? Jordan, thank you, Jordan. France, I think, thought about it in earnest. UK is with us in the United States. So to me, where's NATO? Where's our ally?
Thank you, Congressman. Always good to see you. I appreciate your perspective. I hope we get the amendment to the Ukraine bill that it gets to where you can support it, because I'm a Reagan conservative, too. I'm old enough to have been in his White House, and I know what he would do. He'd say, stand with those who stand with us. Thank you, Congressman Zinke. I'll be right back.
Beyond the sea.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The book in front of me is 2054, A Novel of the Next World War. It's by my guest, Admiral James Stavridis. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh.
How is 2054 doing? Did sales pick up after this weekend's fireworks and attack on Israel?
Absolutely. As you know, the book deals with geopolitics and artificial intelligence. And I suspect there was a nascent artificial intelligence behind the Iranian drone swarm that charged at Israel. So, yeah, the book's doing great. Thank you very much.
Now, Admiral, I read your Bloomberg column. I'd like you to try and communicate to the audience the complexity of the defense net that was thrown up by CENTCOM, and in which Israel, of course, is the prime participant, in the United States, number two, and Great Britain was there, and Saudi was there, and the UAE was there, and Jordan. Just sort of describe how many people were involved in this defensive effort on Saturday night.
This is a huge area to defend, as in Israel. And, of course, I spent my career, as you know, as a captain and commodore and admiral in charge of guided missile destroyers that have this as their primary mission. The hard part is knitting together all the command and control that goes into this. You just ticked off five or six nations. I'd add the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to that. France was also involved.
You're right.
And it begins with satellites above providing information in real time. That goes into multiple command centers where one of them speaking Arabic, another one speaking French, another one speaking English, obviously, another one speaking Hebrew. All of that has to be knitted together in visual context to create a single unified picture. And then the hard part starts, which is allocating targets. When you've got 170 drones coming in, who's going to shoot the three that are right over Damascus right now? Who's going to pick up the targets coming from the south? Will that be an American warship? Will that be an Israeli at point defense? So incredibly difficult, a real feat of modern arms to put this together. And my hat is off to the air defenders, broadly speaking, who knocked down 99% of these incoming projectiles.
It's been widely reported in Israel that Benny Gantz and his colleague in the war cabinet, the Observer, the general who lost a son and a nephew in Gaza, urged an attack on Iran during the attack. But the IDF and Prime Minister Netanyahu took the IDF's report, said, no, that will put too much stress on the system. And I get, you know, that made sense to me. What's it mean to you?
Same. I know General Gantz extremely well. I count him as a personal friend. We worked together constantly over 4 years when he was the chief of the Israeli defenses. I was in charge of U.S.-Israel military relationships when I was the supreme commander of NATO. So I know him very well, and he's a warrior. He's a paratrooper, a fearless fighter. Every bone in his body would say strike and strike now. However, I would say in this case, revenge will be a dish best eaten cold, as Machiavelli said. I think cooler heads probably prevailed appropriately. Now's the time to decide what comes next in terms of retaliation.
Now, the war cabinet has been meeting again today for the third consecutive day, and there are all sorts of leaks, and I don't believe any of them because there's an information war going on. But what's on the menu of possible things, in your opinion, Admiral Stav?
Let's think of it in four buckets. One is go big, throw the entire Israeli Defense Forces might against Iran, take out the nuclear program to the degree you can, very hard target, go after industrial sites, go after military capability, a kind of Israeli version of shock and awe, bucket one. Bucket two, do something against the Iranian homeland itself, probably go against the, for example, factories where the drones are being produced, places where ballistic missile parts are stored, where they're assembled. That's bucket two. Bucket three, a little lighter touch. Perhaps you use cyber to go after the Iranian economy. You could go after maritime targets. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard just seized an Israeli-owned commercial ship. You could go after the targets that provided that capability to Iran, notably their warships and intelligence ships at sea. You could use special forces ashore. That's kind of bucket three. Bucket four, which I highly don't recommend, is do nothing. So where does this land, Hugh? I think probably not the all-out strike, simply because Israel is so engaged in Gaza and beating back Hezbollah to the north. Certainly you don't do nothing. I think you probably strike something on the Iranian mainland. They attack your mainland. I think you feel you have to strike their mainland. And then I think the bulk of your effort could well be cyber and at sea. That coupled with a strike ashore, that would probably be my prescription.
No, Admiral, I know that the F-35s have stealth capability, and Israel has F-35s. I don't know if they can get them to and back from Iran and from whether it's the IRGC headquarters or the nuclear sites or the oil refinery. Do they have that distance capability?
They would require tanker support. Israel has some tanking ability, nothing like the United States. If Israel wanted to go big, they would almost have to include U.S. support. I think that's probably not likely. As a result, I think they'll be pushed to the options that I described.
Now, Admiral, they have land-based cruise attack missiles. I don't believe Israel has ballistic missiles, but you can correct me if I am wrong about that. Does Iran have the same net that can defend Iran as well as Israel defended itself? Because I agree with you. You cannot change the equation, allow the equation to be changed. I just don't see how Israel can do that. But I'm not sure. You also don't want to have anything not get through and be embarrassed, right?
Right. I would say, again, war is unpredictable. And, oh, by the way, Iran has been steadily increasing their air defense capability with the help of Russia. So they have a reasonably strong capability. But what do they lack? They lack the alliances. They lack the unblinking eye of our intelligence and satellite systems. They lack the dispersal of defensive weapons systems. They're kind of concentrated around their principal targets. So if Israel chose to attack, it would be a combination of cruise missiles, perhaps some from the sea, some from land. It would be the air assault we've been discussing. All of that could inflict some real hits on Iran. And let's close with this. You mentioned the F-35. Focus on that number. Here is what Iran flies around in, F-4s. Huh. That's before F-15s, before F-15s, before F-18s, before F-22s. You know, we're up to F-35s now. Iran is still flying F-4s left over from the Shah, few other crummy Russian jets. Their air forces would be toast, not to use a technical military term, in the face of Israel's air forces.
Admiral, I appreciate that very much. Follow the Admiral at Stavridis J on X. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is a... And it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
844-644-1900.
That's...
844-644-1900.
Folks, so many people I know are disheartened that our country seems to have forgotten the importance of citizenship. And they wonder how a strong sense of citizenship might be revived. That's why my friends at Hillsdale College have produced a free online course on the topic, American Citizenship and Its Decline. Taught by historian Victor Davis Hanson, the course traces the history of citizenship and explains how it is undermined in America today by open borders, by identity politics, by the administrative state, and by globalization. Americans taking the course will gain a deeper insight about the connection between citizenship and freedom, an insight they can share with family members, friends, and neighbors. Hillsdale's free online courses are an important component of Hillsdale's mission to reach and teach increasing millions of people on behalf of liberty and the American way of life. So sign up today for Hillsdale's free online course, American Citizenship and Its Decline, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's HUGHFORHillsdale.com. Hughforhillsdale.com. Start your free course today at hughforhillsdale.com.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
The Shah says in his memoirs to come out soon that the West underestimated the impact of his fall, that they did not ever realize how important it would be to the West. Is that accurate?
There's no question that the Shah leaving Iran is a tragedy, a personal tragedy for him, a tragedy for the people of Iran who now are suffering repression much greater than they had before, who have 4 million at least unemployed and runaway inflation under a government that is not really a government, it's really a mob. All these things have happened, but also it was, in addition to being a personal tragedy for the Shah, a tragedy for the people of Iran, it was certainly a tragedy for what we call the West, because what was leadership and stability in that part of the world is now replaced by instability.
Welcome back, America. That was Richard Nixon at the funeral of the Shah Iran in Egypt, which he chose to attend. I'm joined now by Clifford May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Cliff, I played Richard Nixon at the Shah's funeral in 1979. He laid it all out. This is not a surprise that we are where we are. What do we do next?
Look, right now, the U.S. needs to have deterrence, and we do not have deterrence. Deterrence means, first of all, that you have a capability that your enemies see as overwhelming, and that you have the will to use that capability, and so they don't want to challenge you. And I should say deterrence comes in two forms. There's deterrence by denial and deterrence by punishment. Deterrence by denial is what the Israelis did. They said, you can't get those missiles to hit their targets. All right, you're not going to be allowed. But then your enemy says, okay, well, we'll try again, see what we can do. Deterrence by punishment says, if you hurt us, we will make you scream. You do not want to hurt us. There is nothing more important for the U.S. as a whole right now, I think, than to reestablish deterrence with its enemies, which we don't have. We don't have them, and we certainly don't have in the current administration a sense of will, a sense of we can hurt you and are willing to hurt you. Deterrence failed as far as Putin in Russia. Deterrence has failed. Certainly with Iran, it's not enough to say don't. They have to fear what you say don't. But that means something else, I would argue, and that's recognizing that we're in a Cold War. That Cold War is being led by the strongest, richest, most powerful communist regime ever in history. And it has as its junior partners Vladimir Putin in Moscow, Ali Khamenei in Tehran. It also has North Korea. It also has Cuba. It also has Venezuela. If such a Cold War is taking place and it's more challenging than the last Cold War, well, we have to be on a Cold War footing. And we're by no means. The military is being cut. The Navy is being cut. We're spending trillions of dollars on a transition to green energy, which is not so green. And we're spending not nearly enough or doing enough militarily in order to deter our enemies or to win a Cold War or even keep the Cold War from getting hot. How do you keep a Cold War from getting hot? Hot by making your enemies and adversaries fear going to war with you. And that's not the situation we're in.
Cliff, we're going to keep you after the break and play it tomorrow morning and also put in the podcast. But I want to ask one thing for our radio audience that's listening right now. When did you start and when did you leave at the New York Times?
So I was in the New York Times during the 1980s.
So you were there for Reagan.
I just mentioned before. I was there for Reagan. I guess, let's see. I was there from about the age of 30 to the age of 39. and I'm now 73, so that we can figure that out.
All right.
And at a certain point, I left because the New York Times was sliding to the left, and I was sort of getting opinionated. As a young reporter, I was not terribly opinionated. I really wanted to know what everybody had to say.
Stay for a second, Cliff. We got to throw to a break. We're coming right back for part two with Clifford May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll play this part tomorrow in the first hour, and we'll put it on today's podcast, Highly Concentrated Hue. I am back now with Clifford May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Cliff, the reason I asked if you were at the Times when Reagan was president is because Reagan began to rebuild deterrence with Richard Nixon's book, The Real War, under his arm, by a small but winnable war in Grenada. We have a small but winnable war with the Houthis right now. It's astonishing to me that this is going on. Do you think Team Biden will do anything to stop it as opposed to merely continue to spend money and missiles knocking him down?
Yeah, I'm afraid he won't. I'm afraid this constant repetition of the phrase, we don't want to escalate. We want to hold this in check. There is a real problem with the U.S. and really with the West in general of not wanting to win wars, of not thinking war should be won, of not using words like victory for us or defeat for our enemies. So that we, you know, I think Biden capitulated to the Taliban in Afghanistan. I think that we went a pretty long way in Iraq and then decided we were okay to just have an exit strategy and let ISIS take over and let Iran come into Iraq, and we're still fighting that situation. Look, even the Korean War, and there are good reasons, we didn't win that war. That war didn't end. It was an armistice. The result of that is that today we have North Korea, a dynastic dictatorship that is very much in league with our adversaries, particularly communist China, but also very much with Russia and also very much with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they helped build a nuclear facility in Syria that the Israelis tried to, did bomb against American advice, if you'll recall. Yes, if we can get back to a Reagan policy, that would make a lot of sense in this world.
Well, Trump began to do that when he took out and ordered Soleimani killed. That was the beginning of a rebuild of deterrence versus Iran. Iran told us they were going to bomb al-Assad. The people who were on al-Assad at the time, including my son, didn't much care for that. But it was forewarned as forearmed, and they got out of there with 45 minutes to spare. I am just curious. Do you think Trump had restored deterrence? Do you think Trump would have, that Hamas would have attacked or Iran would have attacked Israel if Trump had been president?
Look, I think it's always hard to do hypotheticals, but I think there's a real possibility that he would have said when he said don't, people would have been frightened that he would do it. If nothing else, he was unpredictable.
Yes.
And a lot depends on who's advising him. I think, look, Mike Pompeo, I think, has a very Reagan-esque view of American foreign policy. I think the same of H.R. McMaster. I don't think that of Tony Blinken. I don't think that of Jake Sullivan right now. And I think the other thing, you know, one thing that should have become clear, I don't know if it has, from the attacks over the weekend, is that Iran has been at war, not Iran, really, the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the Iranian people. This regime has been at war with Israel and with America for 45 years. Just before I came to the Times, 1979, I was a young reporter in Iran covering the revolution. And the important thing that I did take away, that I did understand, a lot of my compatriots didn't, is this was not an Iranian revolution. It was an Islamic revolution. This was not about the Shah and how cruel it was. It was rather that the supreme leader, Khomeini, Ruhollah Khomeini, wanted to establish a new Islamic empire because the Ottoman Empire had failed after the First World War. They didn't call it a caliphate. They called it an imamate because they're Shia. But that's what this was about. This was about a new Islamic empire rising and challenging and bringing down the West, the Judeo-Christian West. That's what that revolution was about. People still don't understand that. And it's what it's still about. It's still, when they say death to Israel and death to America, that's what they mean.
You know, the person who did understand, you were in Iran, which may have been the best seat. I had the second best seat in the world for the Iranian Revolution because it was the office of former President Nixon at the Elba of America in San Clemente.
and we were working on the book, The Real War, and we'd have the TV on, and we'd look up, and we'd see the mobs marching. He would shake his head and said, they have no idea what is coming. That is one of two pillars in the Middle East, the other being Saudi Arabia. Well, he's talking about Muslim countries, not Israel. And he knew what would happen. It was predictable. What wasn't predictable is the foreign minister of Iran just threatened Israel that they will respond within seconds if Israel strikes Iran. What that does, I think, Cliff, is push Israel towards having to strike the homeland of Iran. Otherwise, they will have changed the equation. Do you agree with me on that assessment?
Yeah, I think the Israelis can and should act strategically. By that, I mean, I'm sure President Biden is saying we're going to do all kinds of things diplomatically and take a breath and see. For example, the U.S. could snap back sanctions. The U.S. has the power to do that, should have done that a long time ago, so you're not funding both the missiles coming at Israel and the F-15s shooting down those missiles, which is what we're doing. In both that war and the Russia-Ukraine war, we're funding both sides. It's not a very good idea. So see what Biden does diplomatically, see what he does in terms of new sanctions and to squeeze the economy. Revenge or escalation can be a dish eaten cold, after all. And then the Israelis also have to think, we would like to restore deterrence. That's important. Most important thing to do, we have to think how to do this, is not let this regime have nuclear weapons, because if those missiles that had been coming in over the weekend had a nuclear warhead, that would have been a much more serious situation. It only takes, as Ahmadinejad, former president of Islamic Republic, said, it only takes one atomic bomb to wipe out Israel.
Cliff, stop so there think, because the clarity window is closing. What I mean by that is immediately after the attack on Israel, the clarity window was wide open and everyone saw what happened. Every day anyone delays, the clarity window closes. We saw that after 10/7. If they don't hit the Iranian nuclear sites today, I can't imagine under what circumstances we'll ever hit them. Can you? I mean, they're right up to the edge. They're in the breakout mode. If we don't do it now, or if Israel doesn't do it now, we'll never do it.
Well, first of all, the U.S. should do it. This is an international responsibility. The U.S. is the leader of the free world. This is a threat to the free world. That should be done by the U.S., with the Israelis perhaps helping no more. I don't see Biden doing that. From an Israeli point of view, yes, they should do that. But there is a question, you and I don't have the answer to it, of capabilities. Can the Israelis destroy or even set back the nuclear program for 3 to 5 years? Do they have the capabilities in place at this moment? There are difficulties with if they're going to do it via bombers, if they're going to do it, they have to. It's a lot of airspace questions. If they're going to do it with submarines, they only have so many. You have to think they're considering the various capabilities they have. They don't want to try it and fail. That's for sure. I would love to see them do something really creative. I once had a very high Israeli official tell me, in this and other cases, we were speaking this, he said, Cliff, if we do something and you say, yeah, that's what I expected them to do, then in a sense we failed. What has to happen is we do something and you and people like you say, oh, I never thought they would do that.
Yeah, I was listening to your podcast, which is Foreign Podicy, and you told me about it in the green room at Fox, and thanks for the shout-out on that. But I don't need shout-outs. I want people to listen to Foreign Podicy. It was fascinating. I think you had on the former National Security Advisor in Israel. You might have had Peter Ruff on. I can't remember if Duran was on there or not. But I get them all mixed up. But someone was – someone tell me if they have – does Israel have ballistic missiles that can reach Iran? That's a factual question.
I believe they do, but reaching Iran doesn't mean they can hit they don't have bunker busters. How deep they can go. You don't want to just hit the top and have, 100 feet of concrete or rock and stone between the facility and where the where the explosives land.
Well, I don't know about that, Cliff. I'm not an expert on any of this stuff, but it would seem to me that if you put either F-35 munitions on the top of the tunnels at a few of these things, you're going to interrupt their program for at least a little bit. And when the world doesn't blow up, that will be a message to the United States. At least that's how I think about it.
I think it, listen, it's a good theory, and we have experts on missiles and warfare. People like, as you know, like Admiral Mark Montgomery, who and Brad Bowman, and also Ben Talablu, who study this stuff in depth. You and I can be sure that the Israelis are thinking about it, and I do think they understand that they have a list of threats. They have tactical threats, they have strategic threats, and they have an existential threat. Because the existential threat, of course, is from the nuclear weapons. And they would like to see the U.S. take care of that problem, since the U.S. has, in a sense, aided and abetted it for years. But if they have to protect themselves, they will. They need to look at the strategy that has the greatest chance of success. It's not, as they say, a slam dunk, and it's a funny phrase to use in this particular
I want to wrap up. Admiral Montgomery is going to join me tomorrow, Cliff, and I had Jonathan Schasler. I mean, it's going to become an annex of the FDD here, and that's fine. I want everyone to know about the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. So Monty will be on tomorrow, but let's talk about Lebanon for a moment. I had an Israeli veteran of their forces call in, and I asked him, if Israel goes into Lebanon as part of a comprehensive set of responses, and I mean goes in like they did in 1982 without the massacre, like they did the second time, the second Lebanon War, and they clear everything out to the Latani, and they don't suffer too much as a result. They got all the warships there. The defense in depth is still there. He thought more than double the number of casualties for the IDF in Lebanon as in Gaza. Can Israel absorb that? Do you think the government would hold, the coalition government would hold together through that kind of a war?
Look, I think that the Israelis, on a consensus basis, realize that the threat from Lebanon will have to be addressed. Part of what they're trying to do now, this gets back to what we're talking about, is sequence. What do they need to finish up in Gaza? How soon can they do it? How hard is that going to be with Biden, who, as you know, has not been good on this? When do they want to do Lebanon, and what do they need to do about Iran, which is the head of the octopus with all its tentacles? Do I think that the Israeli has a military large enough and powerful enough to be fighting in Gaza, fighting in Lebanon, and fighting Iran at the same time? I think that's stretching it a lot. I think they need to, and I think they will, strategize, sequence, consider the various range of threats and put them in a hierarchy and deal with them that way. We can think it through, but probably I would hope not as well as they think it through in their war cabinet.
All right, Cliff, I want to close this
way. But it
needs
to be done because, you know, there are tens of thousands of displaced Israelis in the north. But right now, because of the rocketing coming from southern Lebanon, and that has to be addressed. And I think it has to be addressed before kids need to go back. People need to go back to their homes in the north. Kids need to go to school. There's a lot here to think about. But I think the big takeaway from all this should be for all of us, when you're watching these people march in the street for Palestine, there's a war being fought against Israel on the front lines. There's a war being fought against the U.S., the Islamic Republic of Iran declared that war back in 1979, and now the Islamic Republic of Iran is in a partnership with communist China, neo-imperialist Russia, and with all of their other allies, such as North Korea and Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela.
Okay, Cliff, I'm going to throw you a very hard and inside pitch because it's hard to answer. There are serious people about national security. You have a bunch of them at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and we'll talk to all of them. Then there's Club Appeasement, the model UN national security team that we've got over at the White House, and I think with David Cameron and Rishi Sunak, who think the world can be talked into coexisting. The first group sits around, studies, and talks. Where does the worldview of never, never escalate come from? I mean, how does that even develop? Wendy Sherman is like their poster child. She did the 1994 agreement with Korea. She did the JCPOA. She's back at the Blinken State Department. Now she's criticizing Israel from the outside. Where does that worldview come from? It's untethered to anything, and it has been since Thucydides.
This gets back to the very beginning of FDD. And the week before 9/11, there I am talking to Jean Kirkpatrick. You know who she was. I hope your viewers and listeners. Right, and Jack Kemp. And they said, America is taking a holiday from history. We're taking a peace dividend prematurely. And they were thinking of the of what we came to call jihadists, those who had attacked us in New York City in 1993, attacked us in Lebanon in 1983, attacked us at Khobar Towers in 96, blew up two of our embassies in 98, attacked the USS Cole in 2000. Here's the one difference. Back then, we thought, I think all of us thought, yeah, we have a real threat from terrorists, from jihadists, from the segment of the Islamic world. But China is going to be a good stakeholder in the international system. Remember in 2001, Clinton brought them into the World Trade Organization. We're going to help make them rich. When they get rich, they'll get liberal and moderate and they'll like us. That's going to work out just fine. Russia, Putin will be okay. Surely the Soviet Union collapsed. The Berlin Wall fell. So back then, when the FDD formed just after the attacks of 9/11, we thought we had a jihadist threat, but no other. Now, today, the international threat matrix is much more complex and worse because, oddly enough, the jihadists are in league with the strongest communist nation in the world and with Russia, which is neo-imperialist. Putin is trying to reestablish, restore the great empire. He sees himself as a latter-day czar. And then there are all the others who hate America. And by the way, they're getting support from countries like South Africa now, which is a shame, but it's also the case. They're all trying to bring down the what they sometimes call the U.S.-led world order, the idea of international law. The U.N. has become a cesspool. It was supposed to be uphold all of this. And we're not facing any of those facts. And we need to deal with this, I think, holistically. Look at the situation. Look at the world as it is and the world as we wish it to be secure for Americans and for other free countries, for our allies.
But Cliff, where does that other worldview come from?
It's constant. It's certainly the Chamberlain view. If Churchill had, died in fighting in South Africa or in Sudan, how would World War II have ended? Probably not the way it did. You always had this view. It's a very seductive view that our enemies, and you saw it, by the way, in Rishi Sunak's most recent statement, which was supportive of Israel, but also nobody wants bloodshed. I'm sorry. There are those who want bloodshed. That's what terrorists are all about. The Islamic Republic wants bloodshed. Russia wants bloodshed. Plenty of people want bloodshed. We have this view. Everybody wants to compromise. Everybody thinks peace is better. Everybody wants a good 401k and a health care plan. Ideology is not to be taken seriously, whether it's communist ideology or whether it's jihadist ideology. That's partly a lack of imagination on our part. We don't think about people being different from us, and some absolutely are. So we think we'll enrich them. We'll make them offers. We'll give them half a loaf. Remember Obama, his strategy in the Middle East was sort of, I used to call it the Mr. Rogers strategy. Everybody's going to share the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. Everybody. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, we'll just share the neighborhood.
It doesn't work. But someday you would think, Clifford May, I'm going to let you go. I've kept you long. Foreign Podyssey is your podcast. It's fabulous. I want more of them, Cliff. I want more of them. Not fewer of them. More of them.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, my friend. Be well. See you soon. In a green room near here and back on the radio. Clifford May, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Thank you.